Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. This week we'll be looking ahead to the upcoming state election in Tasmania, Australia, and also reviewing the results from the Portuguese general election last week. And we'll be asking the big question: will the incumbent Liberals be the last non-Labour state government to fall? It's Sunday, the 17th of March, 2024.
A president who seeks not to divide but unify.
Not now. I am a fighter and not a quitter.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraini!
And joining me, as always, is my co-host Chern. Chern, first of all, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. And unfortunately, and because Sam and I can see each other, but I should let the rest of our listeners know that none of us are currently wearing green at the moment, which is a slight oversight on our part. But there have definitely been a lot of people dressed up as green walking around Brisbane here.
And Chen, it's the first time we've come to each other as well since, one, the Oscars, two, you attending the Eras Tour, which is really the biggest event of the year.
Exactly. So I have seen the cultural phenomenon of the year. and I have to say, at least this year, the Best Picture movie is something that A, I recognize, and B, that I've seen as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's not always the case. Yeah.
But commiserations to Barbie, what I do feel was a bit shortchanged for what a phenomenal film that was. What turned out, Sam, would you not agree? And this is a incredible pivot that we have written on our screen here. Talking about phenomenal results, certainly the far right in Portugal could claim a phenomenal result, isn't it, in last weekend's Portuguese elections?
Yes, well, predominantly this week, we'll be turning our attention back to Australian state level politics because Tasmania is heading to a snap election next week, which is the first of four elections set for Australia in 2024. But actually, this one is the only one that we didn't expect to be taking place in 2024 because this is indeed a snap general election. But yes, as you said, Chern, it was a pretty phenomenal performance, really, for the far right in Portugal. But although we did have that general election last week, it looks like we might be set for a pretty lengthy government formation process in Portugal, Chern.
Well, before we dive into Portugal, I'd just like to point out Australia is not at four elections, important elections. There's, of course, five, actually, I should say, is the correct answer, because we can't forget the Queensland local government elections, including the elections for Brisbane City Council. But yes, you are absolutely right that the Portuguese general election was last week. It turned out to be a much more interesting election than anyone thought. But let's begin our usual analysis by looking at the numbers. So the Alliance for Democracy, which is the Social Democrat-led centre-right alliance, they got 79 seats, up 3, with 29.5% of the vote. Interestingly, 1% down on they were in 2022, which was already considered a poor performance last time round. The governing Socialist Party, as we previewed in our last podcast, got absolutely hammered in these elections. They were punished for a whole litany of corruption scandals that took place over the last two years. They have 77 seats, down 40, with 28.7% of the vote, down 13%. The big winners was Chega, a far-right party led by Andre Ventura, who I suspect will be talking a lot about in this podcast. They got 48 seats, up 36 seats, with 18.1% share of the vote, up 11%. And the Liberal Initiative has got 8 seats, with no change, with 5.1% share of the vote. Other left-wing parties, that includes the Communists, and green parties as well, and other far left parties, got 14 seats, up 1, with 13% of the vote. But there's indication just very quickly amongst these far left parties that there are, even amongst them, that there's been a fragmentation. So Sam, first of all, we previewed it a couple of podcasts ago. What was your reaction to these results that we have right now?
I think the reaction from when we talked about it a few weeks ago is not particularly surprised, because our conversation was dominated by the fact that we thought this was going to be a surprisingly close election. We thought that the Social Democrats, under the new banner of the Democratic Alliance, the Alliance for Democracy, was going to struggle to get anywhere close to a majority on their own, and that's exactly what happened. But I think generally, if you zoom out a little bit, it's particularly surprising, given all of the turbulence in the build-up to Election Day, the way in which this government fell apart, the way in which Antonio Costa had to resign, the kind of opinion poll levels we were talking about in terms of the public's clamour for an election and distrust in the government, that you end up in this position where the Socialist Party are only two seats short of the former opposition. And actually, on paper, even before you start talking about natural alliances, you would say actually the Socialist Party are just as close to being in government as the Alliance for Democracy is on paper after this election day. And I think that in itself is surprising, given the overwhelming dissatisfaction there was at Antonio Costa and his administration in the dying days of that just 3 to 4 months ago. So that's my headline reaction, Chern. What about you?
I think it's a good place to start, because I want to look at the opinion polls, because I think they were really interesting. I think the big thing to me was that after we recorded that podcast 2 weeks ago, we saw the Alliance for Democracy start to surge in the polls. They had, you know, they were looking at about a neck and neck position when we were recording, but by the time the campaign stopped, they had about, like, we're looking at about 34, 35, 36% of the vote. And in the end, they got only 30% of the vote. And even in the exit poll results, they got, I would say, the lower end of the exit poll expectations. The Socialists, on the other hand, I think rather met their opinion, what they were suggesting in the opinion polls, potentially at the upper end. And the far right also was at the upper end of the opinion polls. I think the first thing to note, Sam, is the underperformance of the Alliance for Democracy. And therefore, we come to the factors why the Alliance for Democracy underperformed. And one fact that I'd like to bring up is a rather unfortunate situation for the Social Democrats. And to put their performance in context, I can actually tell you that if we do not consider Madeira First, which is, of course, a Madeira-based political party that only stands in Madeira, the Democratic Alliance, so that's the Social Democrats and the People's Party, actually got less votes than the Socialist Party. It's only because the Madeira component was added that they got more votes. So I think that's the first thing to say. But I also then should point out the National Democratic Alliance. Now, the National Democratic Alliance is, the National Democratic Alternative, and which is a totally different party. It was not running on the Alliance for Democracy list, but I suspect a lot of Portuguese centre-right voters were confused in this election, because the National Democratic Alternative, which is a small far-right social conservative party, they won 100,000 votes in this election. And in the three elections that preceded this, they only won 10,000 votes. So I think there is a big what-if scenario where a lot of voters, and 100,000 is quite a lot, let's say 90,000 voters, were confused and might have voted for this small far-right party when they wanted to have vote for the Alliance for Democracy. And frankly, the Alliance for Democracy only had themselves to blame for this voter confusion, because on the ballot paper, they even had the same initials as well.
Yeah, I mean, quite possibly. I remember you telling me this on the night of the election, and I thought, surely not that has made a difference. But in an election this close, it may well have made a difference. But Chen, do you agree with my general takeaway for this election, which it seems to be that Portuguese people, in the aftermath of the Antonio Costa majority years, seem to want change, but couldn't necessarily agree what that change was going to look like?
Yeah, I think as well, it's the nature of the change that they wanted, because this was not, I think it was because of the fact it was corruption scandals that brought down the socialist government. I think it meant that it was fertile ground for an anti-establishment party, a party against the political elites, to rise in the polls, not necessarily their main political opponents, the Social Democrats, isn't it, Sam?
Yeah, and for sure, Chega hasn't finished first, they've actually finished in third place in this election. They are the big story, because they more than doubled, almost tripled their vote count from just 2 years ago. They are clearly the kingmakers in the battle to form the next government. And although Luís Montenegro, the likely next Prime Minister of Portugal, has said that they won't work formally with Chega, it does seem that Chega's votes are going to have a big impact regardless on who is confirmed as the next government of Portugal and how the budget will be passed. So, Tern, let's talk a little bit about, well, who do you want to talk about first? Chega's performance and what it will do, or the possible next Prime Minister of Portugal, Luís Montenegro?
Before we talk about Chega, Sam, what were your reasonings for why the Social Democrats underperform in this election, particularly against the opinion polls? I gave potential voter confusion. Do you have any other reasons that could explain why the Alliance for Democracy didn't do any better?
I think part of it might have been to do with the kind of campaign that Chega was running, because they were running an anti-establishment, anti-corruption, broken promises campaign, not just aimed at the Socialist Party, but equally aimed at the Social Democrats. So in this kind of context, I think you'd normally expect the Social Democrats to be the biggest beneficiaries of socialist collapse and questions about socialist integrity and broken promises and corruption, etc. But actually, you had Chega there undermining both of those parties. So I think the Social Democrats were disadvantaged, because if you were a voter who didn't want to vote socialist because you were concerned about corruption, throughout the campaign, you would have also ruled out voting for the Social Democrats, because Chega's campaign and the whole narrative of the campaign dragged them into that conversation as well. So I think that was something that became an ongoing problem for Luís Montenegro, even though he's somebody who has never served in a government in Portugal. Yes, he was leader of the parliamentary caucus for the majority of the Social Democratic term in government 2011 to 2017, but he's not been a serving government minister himself. It's very difficult to pin him to some of the corruption that's gone on. But crucially, he did represent the parliamentary caucus at the time when they were going through a heavy austerity period, the Troika period in European politics. So I wonder if that sort of argument disadvantaged the Democratic Alliance cause, because it just made it quite difficult for a lot of former socialist voters who perhaps were very adversely affected by austerity to then move across to vote for the Democratic Alliance. And instead, they just parked their bus in the Chega camp, who got 20%. That's a pretty respectable score for a third party, for a former very minor party in Portugal. And that's just, I think, made all the difference.
Yeah, I think there's something that I was going to say as well, was that the fact that the Social Democrats have not essentially still being punished for the last time they were in government, even though they've been out of government for the last 9 years. People remember those 4 years under Pedro Passo Coelho's government. And I think people still held it against the Social Democrats for some of the austerity and some of the backwards in living standards that many Portuguese people experienced during that period. So I don't think we can rule that out and necessarily.
One perfect example of this is where Chega won the plurality of the vote in one region in Portugal, which was in Faro, which is the Algarve, where the Algarve is situated. And I think this perfectly illustrates the point we're trying to make about the Social Democrats failing to pick up from socialist misfortunes. Because in the Algarve, there has been health ministry issues. They've now three times postponed the construction of the central hospital there. There's been water shortages to fuel the tourist and urban demand of residents there. There's been a heavy amount of Northern European migration, which has driven up house prices there, which is one of the reasons why Chega was able to pick up quite a lot of youth support, because that's a particularly prevalent issue for younger people in Portugal. And you've created the perfect storm for Chega to pick up votes there. Whereas ordinarily, without the Chega factor, I think that kind of discontent would have been aimed at the incumbent government, not at the incumbent government and the opposition, because both of them bear some responsibility for that situation that has arisen in that region. So I think it's the perfect example of ordinarily things that would punish the incumbent government have actually punished both of them.
And the Faro district you talked about, the first time since the 1991 legislative election that a third party has won the district, so a district in Portugal. So a historic win there. And you talk about this plague on both your houses as well. I think it's also important to consider who the leader Chega is, and this is a good segue to talk about Andre Ventura and his appeal. Because I think one of the big things that enabled him, and we should say as well, Andre Ventura is Chega. It's a very much personality-driven party, I would say, very much so than the Socialists and the Social Democrats. And it's something that we have mentioned before on one of our earlier podcasts, but we always need to remember the Social Democrats in Portugal are the center-right party in Portugal. Most Social Democrat parties are the center-left. Not in Portugal. The Portuguese Social Democratic Party is a center-right party, and I think it's very important for us to keep remembering that. But Andrew Ventura himself not only has the right charisma to draw in voters, but I think he as well. I think why he's been able to clearly pick up a lot of support is not only the policy positions that you so articulated there, but he himself is a former Social Democrat, for example, that who left the party to form Chega. So I think being from the Social Democrats itself, rather than the comparison I'm drawing is from Marine Le Pen, who is very much, from the Le Pen family, who has been always from the far right party. I think coming from the Social Democrats formally has given him this respectability to win over a wide range of voters that the Social Democrats couldn't do, because the Social Democrats, Sam, has what I call a PASOK problem. Because if you think about it, PASOK was in power when Greece suffered during the European debt crisis, it had all those issues and had to implement harsh austerity. And the Greek people, frankly, haven't forgiven them for that. Here in Portugal, you have Social Democrats were also in power when you had the debt crisis and they had to implement austerity. And now you have somebody who has left the party, but is somewhat adjacent to it, is willing to work with it, and is not from those original far right aspects. I think that has ensured that he's the right place at the right time with the right charisma to appeal to a lot of disaffected socialist voters.
Yeah, and as we said, André Ventura's campaign he was running was very much aimed at the political establishment across the board. It wasn't a specifically anti-socialist campaign. And Chen, I sort of teed this up before we started recording, but very quickly before we move on to the biggest question, which is what is this government going to look like? Because that's going to dominate the coverage of this election. But I said to you that Luis Montenegro suffered a bit of an anti-corruption story himself when he was running to be leader the first time of the Social Democrats, because he actually unsuccessfully ran for leader in January 2020 against Rui Rio, who was the defeated Social Democrat candidate in the 2022 parliamentary election. He actually lost 53 to 47 to him that time and then absolutely swept the board this time around. But Rui Rio's chief campaign tool against Luis Montenegro was actually accusing him of being a Freemason and member of the Masonic Guild, which, for those who don't know, is a secretive society. It's sort of a secular society, but they have a deity that they conform to, and like they're trying to better society in general. But a lot of l historic leverage at Freemasons have been that they've been using their connections to benefit themselves and other members within society. So when you've got an anti-corruption campaign being run against like people using the establishment to suit their own means, I think that kind of story that has historically been attached to Luis Montenegro was not particularly helpful going into this campaign. So that's just an interesting tidbit I read about Chern. But the big question, what does this government look like?
Well, I think that's a million-dollar question. Wasn't Luis Montenegro, I was reading somewhere, was he also not accused of some corruption scandal when he was a mayor as well? Possibly. I think I might have
I
read
think
that.
it was to do with the property he was living in. I think it was to do with whether, because I think he was living in a multi-million euro property, and the source of that income couldn't quite be traced. And then it came this whole Freemason story as well. So, not a particularly healthy ride for Luis Montenegro up to this point.
Let's move on to what this new government will look like. And we should say Luis Montenegro, for those who didn't know, has been in politics for a while. He was first elected Member of Parliament in 2002 when he was 29 years of age. He was the leader of the Social Democrat Parliamentary Group, as you mentioned, in 2011 under former Prime Minister Pedro Passos Coelho, the last Social Democrat Prime Minister. And he initially had the support of Pedro Passos Coelho when he was running to be the leader of the party, but fell out with his former mentor over how to deal with Chega, because Passos Coelho favored cooperation. Luis Montenegro has steadfastly rejected any deal with the anti-establishment party. And he has, according to sources close to him, he has apparently, quote, a stubborn streak within him. So bearing all that in mind, do you think that the Social Democrats will play ball, Sam? Will the Social Democrats do a deal with Chega to ensure that Luis Montenegro has the numbers on the floor? Because we know something in Portugal, Sam, is that we saw in 2022, where if your budget doesn't pass parliament, in a semi-presidential system, it's often forced early elections. So they're going to need the help of somebody to pass a budget.
Yeah, and I'm struggling to see how we don't end up in a situation where a budget fails to pass, if I'm being completely honest in this moment, because Montenegro has been very, very quick to shut down the idea of any formal political agreement with Chega. What we've typically seen in the past, we saw it in Spain, we have seen it in Scandinavian countries as well, is that parties spend the entire campaign saying that they won't work with a certain party, but then when it becomes politically necessary following the election, they then come out and are much more vague about it. They're talking about, well, we're not completely ruling it out, it wouldn't be the preference. But Montenegro has not done that. This has been very clear. Every time he's been asked, he said he won't work with them formally. And Chega, on the other hand, have said that if they aren't going to work with someone formally, they're not going to entertain any kind of budget negotiations and they're not going to vote for it. So I think it's going to be quite tricky when the Democratic Alliance are 37 seats short of a majority, because you need another big political party to support you. And it's not going to be the Socialists, because they've said that whilst they won't stand in the way of a Montenegro accession vote in the parliament, they're not going to vote for the budget and they're not going to be formally part of the government. They're looking forward to being in opposition. So I'm really, really struggling to see how, unless they do a formal agreement with Chega, they're going to manage to pass any kind of state budget arrangement. And forgetting the state budget, it's that even if you can get the numbers together for the state budget, what on earth does your government term look like if you don't have any kind of even confidence and supply arrangement with another political party? Because you're so far short of a majority that over any issue across the next 4 years, this government could come to an end. So I know that's not really an answer, but I think if I were a betting man, I'd be putting money on us ending up with another election sooner rather than later, whether it's because a budget hasn't passed or whether it's because they realise that governing's impossible.
Well, Chega, in response to the Alliance for Democracy, Chega has said that the Alliance for Democracy, quote, cannot ask for stability by trampling on us. After Luis Montenegro said that he hoped that proposed tax cuts, higher pensions and wage hikes will make it impossible for Chega to reject and therefore allow him and the Social Democrats to govern without any deals with the populists, which I think is, you know, we're well-wishing. And to be honest, I'm struggling to understand why the Social Democrats are so hard-line in this position, because yes, Chega has had controversial positions and controversial sayings. So, for example, Andre Venturia is willing to say things that possibly, you know, a lot of people, other politicians in Portugal will not go there. He's previously called the Roma community as criminals. For example, he has also had policies where including chemical castration for some sex offenders and introduction of life prison sentence. But he has said he's willing to drop some of these policies in order for a governing alliance rather right to centre parties.
I have a theory about the hardlineness of the Social Democrats, and I'll let you see if you agree with it. So my thoughts is that the Social Democrats knew that they were going to end up in a tricky situation because they knew that socialist voters would find it difficult to come across to them when they felt like that they were going to have to form a government with Chega, and likewise they could park at Chega on the way to the Social Democrats. And therefore, I think what they're thinking is, we were going to find it hard to form another government anyway. In all likelihood, we end up with an election sooner rather than later. And for us, would that election be a lot easier if we've had one, shown that we won't negotiate with Chega, and then move into another election where socialist voters feel more comfortable coming to vote for us because they know that we're not going to work formally with Chega? That might be quite an abstract idea, but I'm wondering if there's something in that.
Possibly. But you then run the risk that these voters just return home to the Socialist Party rather than...
We've seen time and time again people fail to capitalise on calling an election thinking that you're well-placed to win it. So, yeah.
Yeah, that draw is very big, my friend. In terms of elections that have gone that way, I think that makes sense, but it's a very risky strategy to do. And I think the possibility of the strategy would rely on voters wanting to punish the Socialist Party for all the scandals over the last 2 years, and that being relatively fresh in their minds. I just think that another election, you might end up with a similar sort of result. What might change the result is if the Alliance for Democracy changes its name and doesn't use AD as its abbreviation. So that might possibly make them in a better position. But Sam, I don't think it changes the point where even the Social Democrats gain a few seats in that scenario, they and the Liberal Initiative will not have the numbers in the parliament. So therefore, you will need to either re-engage with the socialists and form like a grand coalition, or you have to talk to the far right. So I don't think it leaves... So whilst it might strengthen the Social Democrats' hand, I don't think it leaves them better off in another election unless they get so close to the winning line. And the evidence suggests that that does look unlikely. Now, the one thing that could change it is turnout. Because one thing I think why the Social Democrats underperformed in this election was turnout. Because as we know, Sam, traditional centre-right, who is more likely to turn out, it is a higher turnout, is young people, and who are either like to vote for the socialists or in this case the far right, because they are frustrated with the cost of living, house prices, poor quality of services. I think the far right's message could be particularly appealing. And those low propensity non-college voters, where I can tell you that based on some demographic analysis, that amongst voters with no high school or with high school education or no high school graduation, the Social Democrats finished with 26% of the vote, the Socialists at 32%, and Chega at 22%. So with college graduates, there was 36% with the Alliance for Democracy, compared to 23% for the Socialist Party as well. So I think their only hope of getting close enough where they could only rely on the Liberal Initiative is A, change your name, and B, you need low turnout. And even in B, that's a really hard thing to go to the polls on.
So Chen, final question before we move on. Do the Democratic Alliance get into a formal arrangement with Chega this side of a state budget, yes or no?
My answer is there will be some kind of arrangement, but I think if I was Andre Ventura, I don't think I would form a coalition government. I think I will enter into a confidence and supply agreement and at least learn how the ropes and mechanics of government works and allow that slight distance before next time round, which enables you to not be tarnished, I think, and still be able to grow your brand. What do you think, Sam?
I think on balance, I agree. But as I said, I wouldn't be surprised if Portugal is back at the polls sooner rather than later.
I will say this, though. I think if Portugal goes to the polls, they're at 66% turnout, which was up from 51.9%, is their best share of turnout since 1995, and a record 6.1 million votes casting a ballot. I do think that, as in 2022, I think this election, why turnout was so high, was that, as you said, Marcelo Rubio da Silva really wanted to dissolve the government because 80% of Portuguese want so. I think if another election is called, I do think a lot of Portuguese will say, why are we going back to the polls? And that could benefit them. And do not rule out the president's role here. Because what I did find interesting is, did you see his stance? Marcelo Rubio da Silva's stance. He told a newspaper on the day of the election, he would do, quote, whatever it takes to prevent Chega from gaining power. Now, that is open to interpretation. He was criticized for violating neutrality, I should say. But it doesn't mean that I think it says prevent Chega from gaining power. I think that still leaves a possibility, which you don't agree, Sam, of a social democrat confidence and supply agreement with Chega, wouldn't it?
Well, let's see. So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. We'll now be talking about the upcoming snap election in Tasmania, Australia, where Premier Jeremy Rockliffe will be looking for a fourth term for his Liberal Party up against Rebecca White's Labour Party, and it will be Rebecca White's third consecutive election as leader of the Labour Party. And this time, Chern, it will be an interesting one, mainly because the size of the Tasmanian legislature will be changing back up to the 35 that it held pre the 1998 state election in Tasmania. So a lot to talk about here, Chern, as we preview Australian state elections. Both you and I love talking about Australian state elections, but this could be interesting given that we're a year ahead of schedule and we're looking at that fourth term, which will be the first time that the Liberals have attained a fourth term in Tasmania, despite the fact that its immediate predecessor was a four-term Labour government. So, Chern, where do you think we're sitting with this, and why have we ended up with an election earlier than expected in Tasmania?
Well, Rebecca, just a couple of points here. Rebecca White is at quite a journey, isn't it? Her first election was in 2018. In the snap 2021 election, she was actually very heavily pregnant when the vote was called, actually. So, kudos to her for running a campaign and being on the campaign whilst being heavily pregnant. She resigned as Labour leader after the election. She endorsed David O'Byrne, who was elected leader in June 2021. On the 30th of June, David O'Byrne stood down as leader after he was accused of sexting allegations and kissing a woman without her consent. And she returned to the leadership on the 7th of July. So frankly, it's been quite a remarkable journey. And I wonder whether she thought after the 2021 election, whether she'll find herself leading the party again to an election in 2024, which was called a year earlier than scheduled. The first big change, there had been a lot of change in Tasmanian politics, was in April 2022, Peter Gutwin, who was a resigned, and his deputy and that of Will Hodgman, who was the previous Liberal Premier, Jeremy Rockliffe ascended to the premiership. His trouble started in May 2023 when two backbenchers, Lara Alexander and John Tucker, who represent Bass and Lyons, which is kind of like in the central to north of the state, they resigned as members of the governing Liberal Party and from all parliamentary committees, but stated that they would serve the rest of their term as independents on the crossbench, providing the government with confidence and supply. Now, one of the big reasons why they resigned from the Liberal Party was over an AFL stadium, because one of the big things that Jeremy Rockliffe was going to push through was to bring the AFL, which is Aussie Rules Football, to Tasmania, and that a stadium would be built in Hobart. And particularly for a lot of the Liberal caucus, which is anchored in the centre to north of the state, they saw that as a particular big waste of money in which their communities would not get a big benefit. And what we have seen basically from May 2023 was that Jeremy Rockliffe had basically two rather unreliable partners in terms of passing legislation. And I think the penny finally dropped earlier this year when after just one too many demands on the crossbenchers, he decided that enough is enough. Let's clear the decks and let's call an election. Any other events? Was that a good summary, Sam, of what has happened over the last parliamentary term?
Yeah, I mean, I think you summed it up perfectly, because it was that resignation, those resignations that made the biggest difference. Because the Tasmanian Liberal Party did win a majority in the last election, but they won a majority of one. So having two people move to the crossbench and then fail to negotiate a new governing arrangement was just unsustainable, especially in a 25 seat House of Assembly, because your wiggle room is so small, especially when like caucus management is much easier for the opposition parties, because they're managing what, eight people, nine people, rather than managing when you've got it in bigger parliaments where you've got to manage 60 people, because you might have like one or two people decide to support individual government motions. That was just not going to happen in this House of Assembly. So I think having a snap election sort of became inevitable. And especially with these new seat counts as well, it completely sweeps the deck and sets sort of a new era of Tasmanian politics.
I will say this. Now, the reason, did you read Sam, why the assembly was reduced from 35 seats to 25?
It was money saving. It was about paying salaries.
That was the official reason, but did you read the unofficial reason why?
I did not.
The unofficial reason why was that it was a bill put through by both Labour and the Liberals, because under the Hare-Clark system, if you have less seats that you have to dole out per constituency, it would have meant more seats for the major parties and less seats for the Greens, which really emerged as a political force in Tasmania in the 1990s. So it actually, what the impact of that was, when the House was reducing from 35 to 25, is we saw a run majority government from the 1998 election all the way to the 2021 election, with only one exception in 2010, when the Greens was a big enough force to win seats. So the official reason was to save money, but the unofficial reason was that the Labour Party and Liberal Party wanted to keep a majority in the Legislative Assembly. But I think why that calculus has changed, and why they are willing to give up power and increase the threat of the hung parliament situation, is that what has that meant is that when, particularly if you're the government, is that you have a smaller pool to draw on from ministers. And therefore, ministers are often stacked high with a lot of portfolios that frankly meant they were burnt out a lot earlier, particularly those when you had a global pandemic you had to deal with, which just increased the workload of any government.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
this
think I
term of
saw
government.
that 5 of the 13 elected Liberals just 3 years ago have not made it to this election. So 5 of 13 have resigned mid-term.
And four were cabinet ministers. You know, Peter Gutwin, the Premier, Jackie Pratsuma, Sarah Courtney, Elise Archer, they were all cabinet ministers at the start of 2021. They didn't last for this term. So I think practicality had worn out that they just needed more bodies on the floor to form a more effective government.
So Chen, let's talk a bit about the impact of that increased seat count, because you know how much I love talking about electoral systems and electoral maths and things. And this seat count increase, although it was a cross-party support, as you said, is going to have a pretty seismic impact probably on the result of this election, especially this election, because of Laura Alexander and John Tucker, you've got two high-profile independents having led into this campaign. So independence generally is high in people's ethos, and also on the federal level of Australian politics, we've talked time and time again about the rise of independence across the country. You've then got the Greens, who are currently polling on about 14-15%. You also have the JLN, which is the Jackie Lambie Network, named after the Senator Jackie Lambie. So you've got now independents or smaller party candidates now amassing about 40% of the first preference votes, according to recent opinion polls, which is going to have miles more scope on their ability to pick up seats in this electoral system, where it would have been difficult for them to pick up the fourth or fifth seat in five member districts, but picking up the sixth or seventh seat in seven member districts, far more likely. So you're going to have a very different looking parliament after this election as before it, aren't you?
100%. Let me give you an illustration. I saw several websites unscramble all the votes in 2021, and the question on their mind was, what if that parliament in 2021 was 35 seats rather than 25? What the seat allocation is? And this is assuming, well, let's reclassify John Tucker and Laura Alexander as liberals, because they were elected as liberals. What we would have seen in that parliament is 17 liberals, 12 Labour, 3 Greens and 3 independents, which meant that even in the old system, the liberals are one seat short of majority government. So, and that was an election, Sam, where the liberals had got 48.7% share of the vote. I can definitely tell you that the last couple of opinion polls have dropped them between 37 and 39% share of the vote. So they're going to need some kind of coalition, which you not agree, Sam, in order to reach that. And actually, ironically, that leaves Labour, who frankly, if I look at recent opinion polling, one poll did put them at 29%. But in all accounts, Sam, they're going to look like they're going to go backwards on their vote share. But it could put them in a position to form a government, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what I think makes this election interesting, because I don't think anyone is questioning the idea that the Liberals are going to come first in the first preference votes in this election, because they're holding a pretty persistent lead across the board. Jeremy Rockliffe narrowly is the preferred Premier in opinion polls, but we don't really have any recent data on that, to be honest. I think the last preferred Premier poll conducted was in August 2023, so it's not recent data, but nobody's questioning the idea that the Liberals are favoured to win this election in terms of coming first. But when you've got a situation where the Labour Party vote might not change that much, its first preference vote might not change that much, so therefore its seat count may overall not change that much. But what might change is that you get the Greens coming in as a bigger force into this parliament, who are much more likely, well, they're not going to work with the Liberal Party, but they probably would work with the Labour Party subject to some agreements. So are the Liberals going to be left short of a majority enough that they're without enough allies to combat an opposition-led government by the Labour Party? So that's what I think makes this election interesting. And without that seat count change, I don't think we'd be having this conversation at all. It's fascinating.
No, I totally agree. And I think Labour's challenge in this election is that, and we should say as well, that the last time in 2010, when the Labour government was in power, they did a coalition government with the Greens and it ended badly. It ended with the then Premier Laura sacking the Greens in 2014, just before the election. So I think that is still, quote, these are Taylor Swift analogy, bad blood between both of these parties. So I doubt there'll be a formalized arrangement between Labour and the Greens in coming out of this election as there was in 2010. So I think that's the first thing to say about that prospect. But I think the wild card would be is that under the system, Labour only had one seat in Clark in the old 5-member seat. I think they'll definitely gain another member in Clark under the 7-member system. They probably will retain Franklin and Lyons. So Franklin's the other southern seat, and Lyons is where Rebecca White is running. I think it's reasonable to say that they could win an additional seat there. But where to give themselves a stronger chance, which you don't agree, Sam, but is in the northern electorates in Bass and Braddon, which are traditionally at a federal level much more. It has swung between the Labour Party and the Liberal Party. But the problem for Labour is that that's where Jackie Lambie network really plays in the north of the state. And I suspect could attract quite a lot of the disaffected Liberal vote, isn't it?
Quite possibly. But again, that does make it trickier for the Liberals, because every seat they lose to whoever it is takes them further away from having a legitimate claim to the premiership. But don't get me wrong, I think the Liberals are the favourites in this election to remain in government and to win a fourth term. But as we've unpacked a lot, there are some complications that could make that difficult. And you talk about, Chern, big opportunities for the Labour Party in the north of Tasmania. let's bring it back to the original point you made about how we got here, which is about the Macquarie Point Stadium and the disputes over that. Labour have been quite tactical about how they've engaged with that conversation. They haven't said they don't support the stadium, but what they've said is they would like to see the team perform better before they reward them with a stadium, i.e. it won't be a first-term priority. So if you do have Northern Tasmanian citizens who maybe agree with Laura Alexander and John Tucker, is that giving them a pass to maybe vote for Labour candidates in the north of Tasmania? And in a 35 seat parliament, even though it's bigger than the 25 seat, it's still every individual member matters a lot, because that could swing easily. You could have a one seat difference between Labour and Liberals and it make a big difference on who can form that government eventually. So these little things, although it seems like a very niche policy, could make a difference.
I will say then, if the Liberals knew that the parliament size was going to increase, why would you call an election?
I mean, it still doesn't change your electoral maths in that moment, which is they were going to find it very difficult, I think, to pass a budget, because yes, the dispute was over this stadium, but because it's an infrastructure project, because it requires state money, I think you were going to see a situation where there was a bigger showdown. And I wonder if Jeremy Rockliffe was just trying to avoid being even more humiliated when an actual spending bill fails on the floor of the parliament. And actually he was thinking, the time is running out. I may as well do it now before I avoid a bigger problem later down the line.
Fair enough. I think he just got fed up, was possibly, of dealing with this constant, you know, I might get this after the election, but at least I have a mandate from the people to do so.
And also, cynically, it's much easier to say I've won a fourth term if your four terms are all truncated and shorter than they should have been.
Which has been the case in term two and term three as well, because let's not forget the excuse for Peter Gutwin in 2021 and 2024 was that in 2021, the Liberals chose to go to the polls early because they sacked the speaker and therefore they lost the one seat majority, and Peter Gutwin used that as an excuse to go to the polls. At least this time, Jeremy Rockliffe waited a year before he used that same excuse.
So Chern, predictions?
I think it generally is quite close. I think Labour is close enough to possibly be in with a shout, but the Liberals will here's what I'm certain. The Liberals will finish first in the share of the vote. They will lose a couple of seats. But I think we're at a 50-50 stage where they lose a couple of seats, but are able to get some of the independents in a confidence and supply agreement to vote with them and to form a government. And enough where Labour could also do the same in a hung in that situation as well. So whilst I'm pretty certain that Liberals will finish first in votes and seats and Labour will finish second, I think it is a little bit uncertain to me who the government will be. And I think a lot of it will depend on how many other parties will get elected. I think the Greens will probably probably gain one more seat, possibly two. But then it could come down to the independents, Sam. And have you had a chance to look at the other independents like Laura Alexander, John Tucker, Kirsty Johnson, and some of the others? And how many do you think they will be elected? Because I think the answer to that will be able to find out who will form the government.
Yeah, well, I think I would favour people like John Tucker and particularly people like John Tucker and Laura Alexander. As independents, you rely on high voter recognition and name ID. Well, they have that in spades because they've been at the centre of the reason that this government is no longer functioning and is going to a snap election. And when you've got seven member constituencies, the sort of de facto quota you need if you're guaranteed to win a seat is 12.5% of the vote. Could I see both those people getting close to that? Absolutely. Absolutely I could. And for every seat in a 35-member parliament that is won by somebody like that, or the Greens, it makes it trickier for either party to form a government, but I think disproportionately trickier for the Liberals.
I think so too. I think it's quite interesting to what happens in Clark, because in Clark we got Kirsty Johnson and also Sue Hickey, who's a former speaker who is running for her for she lost a seat in 2021. I think she is running again in 20 in this election. So it'd be really interesting to see whether she gets up as well and further add to the crossbench.
I mean,
as
in
well.
Franklin, you've got David O'Byrne running as an independent candidate who was the 22-day-long leader of the Labour Party.
Exactly. And so that's going to complicate Labour's figures in Franklin as well. So lots of interesting dynamics at play. And I think we may not know, we might get indication on election day, but unless one party comes sufficiently close, I suspect it'll be a big scramble. Because what we saw in New South Wales, Sam, if you recall, was that Labour was only two seats short of majority. So I think it was relatively easier for all the other independents to fall in line because Labour was so close to majority government. I think that's what the Liberals are hoping, is that they can come close enough and now Jeremy Rockcliffe's own mandate that they will be able to form a government. But Sam, I think what we have seen is that, and in this has been case in centre-right parties, is that the Liberals have had a little trouble with minor parties, and I think the Tasmanian Liberals will have to play nice with them over the next 4 years. Would you not agree?
Yeah, Chern, I know we're only in March, but I'm starting to build a bit of a narrative heading towards our year-end review so far, certainly our half of the year review, because how many times in 2024 now have we talked about an election where we're saying, I don't think we'll know the government formation outcome immediately? I mean, it's starting to become a bit of a theme. So that'll be interesting to unpack as we move through 2024, because elections are becoming pretty competitive. And I think the rise of third parties, fourth parties, independents, smaller groups, people more being more willing to shop around the electoral system is making electoral maths pretty complicated. I mean, just look at the Netherlands, who this week, Geert Wilders has said he doesn't want to be prime minister anymore, or has abandoned the plans to be prime minister because he just doesn't have the numbers, and we're still negotiating over there. And of course, Portugal, we think, are going to be negotiating for quite some time. And now Tasmania, we think, could be pretty close as well. So it's becoming interesting.
I will say, though, Australia's, I think, in 2010, took 14 days to form a government. So it won't take long for them to pass the longest government ever formation. I think there'll be a lot of impatience for them to form. And you want to talk about government formation, Sam. We've got the Belgian elections this year. So when we actually
review
those...
Yeah, strap yourselves in, folks.
Yeah, how many days did it last take to form a government? It was definitely over a year. I think
it was definitely in the 500s, I think.
It was definitely in the 500s. And you talk about close elections, and well, we're going to be talking about the Indian elections in a couple of weeks' time. Now, there are a lot of people voting, but whether it's close, I think our narrative could be broken there, don't you think?
Indeed. But Chern, I think for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Please do join us again next time in a couple of weeks when we'll be reviewing the results of this Tasmanian state election, and we'll also be reviewing results of a parliamentary election taking place in South Korea. As always, we'll continue to keep you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world, and you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at @ballot_talk, and please do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us, or even email any feedback or comments you have to ballottotalkabout@gmail.com. My name is Sam, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.